Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Quarantine Break Podcast. How are you doing? I hope you're keeping well and safe out there. My guest today is the wonderful playwright and screenwriter James Graham. He's the man behind so many great TV shows and plays, including Brexit, The Uncivil War, Coalition, This House, and most recently, Quiz, based on the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire coughing scandal and officially the most watched TV drama of the year. I spoke to James just hours after he appeared on Question Time, where he talked passionately about how the arts have been dealing with lockdown. We talk about that, Quiz, and loads more. Take a listen and I'll see you at the end. Hello, James. How have you been keeping?
Hi. Fine. Like everyone else, it's a discombobulating roller coaster. Sometimes absolutely okay. Sometimes absolutely fine. Moments of strange happiness, and then sometimes impossible lows. But you know, that's I'm accepting. I'm accepting of that. How about you?
I'm good. I'm not too bad. I think like you, I have good days and bad days. Some days are really good. I'm thinking, I'm never going to go back to an office again. I just live in my house now. I can go and work outside. Very often though, it's just me sat at my dinner table trying to do some work and just thinking about getting back to some version of normality.
Yeah, that sounds good.
I have to start with the fact that we're recording this on Friday, and it's the day after you were on Question Time. As a panellist, I should point out, you weren't sitting in the audience yelling. How did you find that?
It was... These are obvious things to say, but I did actually find it quietly terrifying. Mm. You spend the days leading up to it really overthinking your arguments. You start to write points down that will sound too rehearsed, and then you walk into the studio, and it's a bizarre artificial studio at the moment anyway. Mm. So you can't touch anybody, you can't shake hands, and you have to be really separate from the rest of the crew and the people. So you feel like strangely in a lonely wilderness. And then the studio lights go, you hear the famous theme tune, and every thought you've ever had leaves your head, and you go, I don't have an opinion about literally anything. It was mildly terrifying, but I was pleased, reasonably pleased with how it went. We managed to fight for about 10 minutes of airtime to talk about theatre and the unique threat that this poses to culture and film production and arts and live performance, which is going to be an ongoing, slightly exhausting case to make to the government, but it's a start.
I will come on to some of the stuff you chatted about last night, because I think how lockdown has affected culture and the arts is a really, really important conversation to have. But James, this is a tea break, so we need to get the question that has everyone on tenterhooks. And Will Arnett retweeted this podcast yesterday. Hi, Will. So somewhere Lego Batman is awaiting your answer. James, and I feel like Chris Tarrant with all this build-up, how do you take your tea?
So... very boring, but very classic. I would say traditional. I take my tea. I used to have sugar. I now have no sugar. I have a splash of milk. Since the turn of the year, I made a commitment to try and eat and drink less cow. And so I'm experimenting with oat milk. I'm experimenting with coconut milk. So that's been difficult, I'm going to be honest. But it's quite hard to put new milk in your tea and learn to enjoy that taste. But I'm pushing through, trying different combinations, trying different ratios, and I'm getting there.
I mean, we can all relax now. That's the hardest bit of the podcast. I mean, I've had
How did I do? Is coconut milk in tea? Do you want to just stop talking to me now?
I think coconut milk is right. Oat milk, I'm not so sure, because that starts to taste a little bit porridgey, I feel.
You're not wrong. And I went through an almond phase, but then of course I started Googling almonds, and they're in and of themselves, they're incredibly problematic in terms of the energy cost it takes to grow those. So you try and do good, and then you end up doing worse. And you know, it's really hard to be good in the modern world. So I'm just saying I'm on a journey, and I'm gonna get there.
Yeah, every time I think I've done something right and I'm saving the planet, it turns out I've done the complete opposite.
Yeah.
So this podcast is about taking a tea break from the world, a world where, upon hearing small concessions might be made to lifting lockdown, people literally and immediately started a conga line. And my God, they look smug.
They did. And I looked smug by not being there. I felt incredibly smug to not have to do that.
I don't think I've been as mad about a conga line since probably the last time somebody tried to make me join a conga line.
To be honest, I kept thinking, I found in my nervousness in appearing on Question Time and how I might misjudge a certain moment, say, I thought of the conga line, and I thought, well, no matter what, I'll never misjudge anything as badly as they misjudged that. So I took peace in that.
It's just, I think it's just the look on their faces as they're doing it. Like they realise exactly what the gravity of the situation is, but they don't care.
I don't think in peacetime you don't look good doing a conga, yeah. But I think in quarantine, I mean, bless them, they tried. They had the rope, didn't they, and the 2 meters. Little knots, but yes, look, we'll forgive and forget, maybe, unless they killed tens of thousands of people by doing it, in which case screw them.
James, how has lockdown been for you?
I imagine exactly the same as everybody else. Those first couple of weeks were horrible. It was the speed in which it happened. One morning, life is just as it normally was, with this looming fear on the horizon, and then the next day, everything had changed. It just felt so so immediate and so stark. And I guess particularly because of the what is joyful about my job and my industry,
it's so
wonderfully collective. It's a community. You make theatre, and you're surrounded by hundreds of people in an auditorium, and the conversations you have, the beer you have in the interval, and the drink you have afterwards, it's an act of glorious physical proximity. And even the making of television dramas and plays and musicals and films is a wonderfully communal endeavor. So for that to stop immediately and stop so brutally, the lights to go off across the country, was emotionally, spiritually, politically, culturally, just very, very, very hard. And I couldn't really believe how unproductive I was. The one benefit I thought was I woke up on day one as my diary, like yours and everybody's diary, completely emptied and with nothing to do in the evening. I thought, my God, I'm going to be productive. This is going to be great. Yeah. I'm going to write that novel I've been talking about for 10 years. That just didn't happen. I was so surprised at how hard, given I spend most of my life on my own, I live alone, and I spend a lot of time writing on my own. I couldn't believe how that, even that normal standard of basic writing rhythm was completely destroyed. I was sleeping at weird times. Yeah. I was eating at weird times. I was staring at my computer, not doing anything. I was on my phone all the time, trying to connect with the world and feel connected. And so, yes, about a fortnight in, I just had to let go of the shame and the embarrassment around that, I think, and just accept that there was no normal way. Yeah. To lock up 60 million people and it go okay, and it's just going to be strange.
I feel there's almost a backlash now about that kind of sentiment, that you have to use this time to be incredibly productive. In fact, I think I read on the BBC that it's been labelled toxic productivity.
Oh, I've not heard that. That's brilliant. Yeah. Well, I mean, we all know it intuitively, and of course we have to be kind to ourselves. But yes, there was a... there was a theatre meme that went across social media about, well, you know, in Shakespeare, in the plague in Elizabethan time, Shakespeare wrote King Lear. Oh, yeah. And like, oh, fine, well, good for him. I'm really pleased. And actually, that's probably not true. But yes, no King Lears have come out of me at the moment, I'm afraid.
I'd actually say that, strangely, I have been enjoying a little bit of extra time at home. Not to the extent that we've all had to stay at home, but I have been enjoying a little bit of extra time at home. Has there been anything during lockdown that you actually think, this has been nice, this has been better even?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I spent a lot of time on tubes and buses. And I think one of the, which, you know, can be all right, but I don't, in the same way that I don't do lockdown very well, I don't do tubes very well or buses very well. I don't read that book and enjoy that time. I don't sit there thinking helpful thoughts or meditating on life. I'll probably just be on my phone. Yeah. So actually, and one of the benefits, I hope, as much as I can't wait to be back in a script meeting with a producer tearing my work to shreds, that'll be a joyful day when that happens. I think probably like you and anyone in any sector, the realization that you don't always have to travel in and have that meeting and then travel home, you can actually do it on FaceTime or Zoom, will be really helpful. Most meetings, most things you have to talk about in a meeting, you can probably get done in 20 to 30 minutes, but you need the first 10 minute preamble. How are you? What did you do at the weekend? And you need the 10 minutes preamble afterwards. And then getting to and from these places takes 45 minutes, an hour for me. So that would be great if we can hold on to that. As much as I want to be in a room with people again, let's just be really strategic about when that's important.
Yeah. I mean, so much has moved to the digital sphere since the world was shut down. Have you been doing any of those digital experiences, like learning to make cocktails on Instagram, Saturday night Zoom pub quizzes?
Yeah. I mean, I love a quiz. Hence why I wrote the television drama as a celebration of game shows and quizzes. That was a love letter to what I absolutely adored growing up. And most of my teenage years, when you and anyone with a social life were probably in parks drinking cider with your mates, I was with my grandparents watching Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. So Saturday night Zoom quizzes for me are just basically what the 90s were. To be honest, that stuff has been a huge positive. It shouldn't have taken a global pandemic for me and the five guys who were best friends at school to get back in touch with one another and see each other on the same screen and meet their kids over a Zoom, but to say hi. So that's been really wonderful. And yes, we do have I have a great friend who is the quiz master on our friendship group's quiz, and he goes all out. Every week there's a different theme. He has a theme tune. He has a jacket. He has an amazing Zoom background. Thinks of very inventive rounds. There's always a picture round. He has a great round, which is Where Am I Now?, where he changes his Zoom backdrop to an obscure city in Europe and we have to guess where he is. Oh, I think last week we did, do you remember Finders Keepers? It was like a CITV game show.
Oh, that was an incredible show. Neil Buchanan, I think, presented.
Neil Buchanan, yeah. Exactly, the Austat guy. And he, you know, you basically go into different rooms of a house on a set and tear it apart to try and find a specific item. So last week we did a Finders Keepers round where he gave us a list of items and a minute. We had to just run around our house finding things and bringing them back to the screen, and whoever was quickest was first. That was the most exercise I think I've ever had. We did a drag race one week. We don't get warning of this, by the way. That's why it's terrifying. He tells us that it's a drag race round and we have 4 minutes to drag up and away we go. So yeah, I love that.
I really hope there's a controversy linked to Finders Keepers now, because I would love you basically to bring Finders Keepers back. That would be amazing.
If that's the outcome of lockdown, then it would totally be worth it, yeah.
We'll be talking about quiz very shortly, but why do you think so many people have been turning to quizzes in particular during lockdown? It seems like there's so many of them.
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot, and my answer is probably too general and crude to be remotely true, but I think there is something. I fundamentally don't think it's a coincidence that pub quizzes were birthed in the UK. as a phenomenon. They started around the 1970s, but they really proliferated in the 1990s as quiet pubs needed to work out what to do on a quiet Tuesday or Thursday. And they've gone around the world. And, you know, I have friends in America now where they call them trivia nights. Yeah. But bars and pubs doing them to great frequency. So, but I think what it is about the British is, tell me if this is stupid. we are a sociable breed by default, I think. But we are also, there are things that we find difficult. And this is a national stereotype, I know, but there is an element of social awkwardness and privacy and slight emotional repression that means we desperately want to interact with people, our friends and our neighbours, but we need a bit of a safety net and a security blanket to do that. So I think there's something about a quiz which allows you to share something collectively with people, but there is a structured event around it that means you never stray into accidental intimacies,
yeah,
or vulnerabilities. You're not going to actually talk about the fact that you're a bit sad at the moment or that you're worried about your dog because you've got to answer a question about how long was Queen Victoria on the phone for. And so I just think it helps us. It helps us to do what we want to do, which is be together and interact, but protects us at the same time.
I genuinely think it's exactly that. I had the same conversation with someone over Zoom, obviously. And I think it is that. We want to be with people, but we need an activity. We need something else. We can't just admit that necessarily that we need to talk to people. We need to do a quiz, or we need to talk to them that way. We need to debate on what the answer is.
Yeah. And actually, I don't know if you agree, but the only downside to the proliferation of Zoom quizzes is, as glorious as it is, it does lack what I think is the most important and brilliant aspect of a pub quiz, which is the whispering and the conferring.
Yeah.
And because I live alone, I don't have anyone to whisper to, so I have to whisper to myself, and that takes away what I think is the most wonderful part of it. It's how you go, and this is, I know we're going to talk about it later, but this was what I thought the genius of the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire format was.
Yeah.
It wasn't the £1 million prize fund, and it wasn't the dramatic lights or the thumping music. It was the first time in British television where there was a multiple choice,
yes,
question,
yeah, yeah,
and that there was no clock. So normally you're watching Mastermind, and if you're lucky, you might get a chance to think what the answer is and get it before the contestant does, but probably not. And ditto University Challenge. Whereas Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was an interactive show for the people at home. You've got time to argue with your dad and your mum or your wife or your husband. And what a brilliant question demands of you. I used to think a brilliant question was, oh, you either know it or you don't. That's the worst question.
Yeah.
That's terrible. The best question is that it allows you to go on a journey to get to possibly the right answer by trying to remember all of your lived experiences. So what is the capital city of blah, 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 blah? And you turn to the person you love and you go, didn't your mum go there? No, she went to there. Oh, God, course. No, but I thought on Facebook, she said, and you go on a journey. And it means you can just summon memories, good memories and bad memories. And that's what a great pub quiz is, and that's just not quite the element of a Zoom quiz because you don't get to talk to anybody.
Although I will say the best Zoom quizzes I've done, I think, have all been multiple choice, precisely for that reason,
okay,
because there's a bit of debate about it, or you can just put in something quite ridiculous as one of the options and have a laugh about that.
Yes, exactly. So here's another thing. I promise I won't get too geeky, but I loved finding out that because Millionaire was the first multiple choice game show, you have all these great question setters, and I think question setters as a breed of people deserve their own spin-off series because they're so fascinating. A lot of them in the days of classic game shows sort of lived and worked together in a house in Liverpool. It's really fascinating, and they would send these questions on a floppy disk encrypted down to the studio. It's standard practice that, of course, if you are saying that this is the right answer, you need a couple of sources to back that up. What they hadn't factored in when they were doing multiple choice questions on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is that you then also need to get sources that confirm that this is the wrong answer. And that's actually really hard. Yeah. It's really easy to find two sources that say that Elizabeth II is currently the Queen of England. It's actually quite hard to find written proof that Victoria Beckham is not the Queen of England. You have to go and find that. And I think, I don't know what that says, but I think it says something about the nature of truth and lies. It's really easy to prove something is real. It's really hard to prove something isn't. And was something that speaks to our post-truth crisis at the moment. I think there's something in that, weirdly.
That's honestly amazing. I'd never thought of that at all. Like, I'd always assumed that question answers had been double-sourced. I mean, that's very BBC, isn't it?
Yeah.
But to have to prove that something isn't false. Wow. What an incredible detail.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Thanks for sharing that. While we're chatting about digital things, your wonderful play, This House, is on National Theatre live on May 28th. Have you seen much digital theatre?
I have a bit. I mean, again, I think we should all, nobody should be shamed into watching everything and feeling guilty if they don't want to or can't. And there has been a glorious proliferation of digital culture and creativity. A lot of it is completely grassroots outside of our major institutions. It's just people at home recording a monologue and on their phone, and that's glorious. But I started to get quite sweaty in those early weeks at how many things were coming out, and I found peace that you don't have to watch everything. But I've tried to, yes, I've been watching the National Theatre at Home plays, which are just so wonderful, and I didn't really in the old world go and see much classical music or chamber music or anything like that. Just wasn't really my thing. But the Lincoln Center in New York are doing, I think they call it like lunchtime recitals, where they play old clips of symphonies and things or chamber music. And because that comes out around cooking time here in the UK, I've tried to be engaging a bit with that. It's just quite a nice thing to have on in the background.
Yeah,
and it makes me feel very the idea that I'm at the Metropolitan Opera in New York or something whilst I'm in my jogging bottoms at home trying to cook an egg feels really lovely.
For people who are about to tune into This House, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so it's a play that we staged, I think it's nearly 8 years ago now, originally in 2012, and it was my first play commissioned for the National Theatre on the South Bank, and it takes place in the building opposite it, on the North Bank, the Houses of Parliament. And I started writing it, it was just after the 2010 general election, when we had what felt like at the time a huge novelty, something called a hung parliament, and I hadn't had one of those in my lifetime. And most people hadn't. Well, that's not true. But in order to make sense of what challenges and stresses and strains a more collegiate or collaborative form of government does in our system, which normally demands strong majority government, I thought about going back in time to just see the last time that happened, and that was the 1970s. And gloriously for me, I'm sure this is embarrassing to admit, I'm sure the people who were alive at the time will remember this, but I just couldn't believe how extraordinary that period of time in Parliament was. For those who remember it, it was the age of, because there was no majority for the Labour government, Wilson and Callaghan, it meant that every vote was being won or lost by one or two. So it pushed the system to absolute strain. And as normally happens in our glorious, particularly English institutions, the end point of that is often farce. So you have these bizarre, blackly comic moments where, because they needed every party needed every MP to come in and vote if they could. And because of our gloriously archaic system that means you vote with your actual body, you have to move your body physically down the lobby and walk past a teller to count you. It meant that they had to get everybody in, and that sometimes meant in quite an old parliament where lots of members were elderly or sick or in some cases dying, there were sights of ambulances turning up into New Palace Yard and people being carried or helped or lifted across the line if they could be. And if they couldn't be, they would stay in the ambulance and two whips from opposing parties would have to go and see quite if that member of parliament was alive enough to be considered to have attended the vote. And voted in a particular way. So it's, yeah, it was incredibly, quite farcical. But yes, essentially that's it. It's a play that looks at our democratic system, which is very old, very medieval, has lots of strange rituals and procedures to it. And it's mainly set in the whips office, the whips of the Labour whips and then the Conservative whips.
I mean, with this House coalition, the vote, and of course, Brexit, the uncivil war, Dominic Cummings, whatever happened to him, eh?
Yeah. God.
You've charted some of the biggest moments in recent British politics. I mean, I wish there weren't so many for you to chart, if I'm honest, but here we are. Are you somebody who looks at the last 3 or 6 months, if you're looking at the science, and thinks, I need to write about this?
No, not at all, really. That may come one day, but I don't assume the right to. I don't assume a monopoly that it's on anything real life that's interesting, that it's my place to tell that story. I think there were loads of better and talented voices that will be able to maybe tackle this specific crisis than I would. I also just don't know what this story is.
Yeah.
I think, strangely enough, immediately after the referendum happened, I think I know what this is, and then set about writing it quite soon, hence all of those think pieces that came out around Brexit, discussing whether or not it was too soon to have that film out with Benedict Cumberbatch. I just don't really know what this is or what the angle on this is. Is the story the government and their response to it? Is it the science? Is it the human experience of locking up the entire population and what that felt like? Is it the NHS? Is it something less literal than that, more abstract, more absurd? Because this is a very huge and weird and very long Beckett play that we're all living in. I don't know, but I think you have to be honest with yourself that if you don't feel it, if you don't instinctively feel it, that you probably shouldn't force it.
I had Rufus Jones on the podcast and he said exactly the same thing. So he was working on, I think, series 3 of his immigration comedy Home, and he put that on hold because... Exactly that. He didn't know what the story was. He didn't know who are the heroes, who are the villains, and what and how the narrative will change. I suppose in terms of dramas and comedies coming back, and this is Rufus that I'm stealing this from, but it's almost a bit like 9/11. Such a massive event has happened to such an amount of people. And how does culture respond to that? How do you approach it as a TV series, as a comedy, as a drama, and particularly for returning shows or long-running shows like soaps?
It's really interesting, isn't it? And look, an answer will just emerge, and it probably won't be uniform across dramas and stage and screen. But you're right. I mean, the first thing to say, there's two problems, isn't there? There's how do you literally make stuff anyway? And that's in and of itself a dilemma. The second thing is how do your dramas, your characters absorb what we all just lived through? Because presumably those fictional characters have just lived through it. So I don't know, on Coronation Street, is the next episode just going to be Ken Barlow leaving the house and going, oh, that was awful, wasn't it? But I'm glad we've finished lockdown. What does it feel like? Did your characters lose somebody to the coronavirus? So even though I'm writing television dramas that were commissioned in the old world that hopefully will be made eventually in the new world. But I have to now think, even though maybe people won't mention it specifically, they lived through it. That town, that community, that family must have been in lockdown. Did that, and how that changed them, and how their circumstances have changed, how that's changed them psychologically, spiritually, emotionally. So I just think, you know, basically, also actors are brilliant. The actors will just do that anyway. The actors will absorb what it now feels like to be a 21-year-old kid who didn't get to celebrate their A-levels or their degree or something. I don't know. I think it'll be there, but there'll be no uniform response.
We briefly touched on creativity during lockdown, and it has been a struggle for a lot of people. But how have you found being creative in this time?
Very difficult. And previously, one of the things I learned about myself and my own process was that unless I got up early and started early, I would never start. I would love to be that romantic playwright who does nothing all day, maybe drinks all day, and then about 11 o'clock at night, you light a candle and turn on the music and start typing, but that just isn't me. So I always try to get up early and start and hit the ground running. So that was the weirdest thing, because I found it really hard to get up early and I found it really hard to sleep. And you just start moping around. And so I've tried to find structures. I've tried to find rhythms, and basically that. And it's the results are mixed. Sometimes there are good days and sometimes there are bad days, but I am I'm slowly moving through my work, and actually people, that's the only depressing thing, and not to repeat myself, but from the very, but not only am I not doing more work with the extra time I've had, I'm slower on the work I had to do, so I've been missing deadlines, frankly, which is weird, because all I'm doing is sitting at home, so it's weird, and it's hard to have that conversation with a theatre director or the television commissioner, because they know I'm not out. But there is a tolerance and an understanding, and frankly, also, most deadlines are arbitrary and false dilemmas anyway. But given the fact that we don't know when theatre is going to come back and if there will be a British film industry to speak of, it's, you know, to say this must be in at 4 o'clock on Tuesday, otherwise we can't make it, is a kind of a false dilemma because we just don't know anymore. So yeah, there's a tolerance.
Yeah, last night you talked so eloquently about the effects that lockdown has had on the arts. I read in the FT that arts and cultural organisations have lost 95% of their income. That amounts to 330 million, I think, for theatres alone. This is a really, really tough time for the arts.
It's extraordinarily tough. And obviously, it goes without saying, it's tough for everybody. But thankfully, I think we're going to see, obviously, in the coming months, a lot of businesses be able to slowly return, probably on less income, huge impact on people's ability to survive. But the other businesses are thankfully about to be able to start. And we just can't. Yeah. And so we need to have a quite urgent, and I imagine difficult, conversation with the government, that because theatres were the first buildings to close, and they closed willingly. Yeah. They didn't wait for the government even to mandate it. If you remember that bizarre week in March when it first happened, there was no government mandate that these buildings should close on Monday. Yeah. But on Monday night, every theatre in the country took it off their own steam to do so, because nothing is more important than human health and human life. And we did that before the restaurants, before the bars, before the gyms, even though it obviously devastated our finances. So I think the industry deserves huge credit for that. So it's the first buildings to close in the global pandemic, and it's the very last buildings to open, possibly until next year. It's now, weirdly, it's kind of, the choice is now, it's so clear that there's a kind of peace in the choice. It's not a either or anymore. It's either we have these things or we don't. And if the political choice is, I think it's probably a good thing to have 1,000 theatres across the country in Nottingham and Leeds and Sheffield and Edinburgh as civic buildings that play a vital role in people and communities' lives, then unfortunately they need cash, and it's that simple. And it's as I said last night, it's not a bailout, it's an investment. And all we need is to bridge the downtime, to bridge the darkness, and then that investment will come back tenfold, as it always does once we can earn money again.
We chatted briefly about some of the digital content that people have been creating. So we've seen plays on Zoom, TV shows with skeleton or no crew in some cases. ITV did an isolation drama. Yeah. Can TV and film find a way to exist within this world, or is that an unsustainable model?
It can exist a bit, but we just have to be really honest that it's not as good. Well, maybe that's unfair. It's good in a different way. But I think storytelling on screen is glorious, and I think it matters to people. It's entertaining, but it also helps us make sense of ourselves and the world around us. And we got to a point, I'm sure you'll agree, just before the lockdown, where decades of investment and the encouragement and enrichment of talent meant that it was pretty good. Like television started to get really good, whether that was the glossy dramas on Netflix or Fleabag or Normal People or anything. You couldn't really, in terms of production values, you couldn't really tell any difference between film and television anymore. And we're just very good at it in this country, and we don't talk about that enough and mainly because, you know, the left like to self-deprecate any kind of sense of patriotism, and understandably so. But you know, we should champion the things that we're good at and that matter to people. So I think good drama demands those levels of those standards. Basically, you need people. You need to see two people in the same frame, and you want your characters to kiss sometimes, and punch sometimes, and fight sometimes. Macbeth needs to stab what's his name, and Romeo needs to kiss Juliet. So we will have to find a way to get back to that. And, you know, that will happen. And testing and tracing and tracking and all that stuff will help that. But yeah, I don't think there's any, I don't think the halfway house is tolerable for much more for a mainstream audience.
Exactly that. We're almost in this strange situation at the moment. So much good TV is still pouring onto our schedules, and that's through every service: Netflix, Amazon Prime Video, BBC, ITV. And that's obviously because they were all filmed pre-lockdown and all finished and edited, and obviously there are still more great TV shows to come. But we've got this false sense of security at the moment, because at some point it will stop.
That's so true. I think there's probably slight complacency and understandably in an audience's mind at the moment, thinking, well, this is okay, actually, this is fine. But that's because we haven't started yet. The autumn schedules on your linear television are going to be very, very different. And it will take, so what is it? It's been two month delay to filming. That is going to, you're going to notice that. Also, this is probably a boring point to make, but because we're so good at this in the UK, and because other countries come here to make their work, whether it's the Star Wars movies or television dramas, HBO, Game of Thrones, whatever, we were at absolute capacity in terms of producing in this country. It was actually quite hard to make a thing, because you need your director of photography, you need your cameraman, you need your crew, you need your production designers, and everyone was employed. And so you just sort of had to wait your turn a bit. The knock-on effect of all these delays mean that the many TV dramas and films that were meant to happen, that were meant to start in, I don't know, October, November, December, they're not going to start then, because we have the things that were already in production need to be produced. And then it's going to be an absolute scramble for resources and talent. And so some things will be postponed, some things will be cancelled, some things will whatever. So it's going to be an interesting bun fight, that's for sure.
You said last night, quite rightly, it's not just about sustaining theatre. These are the places that create Phoebe Waller-Bridge's. It's where Quiz was birthed. It's a platform, it's a playground, it's a school for so many people, right?
Yeah, 100%. And I'm worried of making theatre sound like it exists only as a training ground for then theatre and television to take them where they really belong. It's not the case. It's not a pipeline. It's a circle. All three of those elements, film, TV and theatre, feed back into one another in a glorious infinite cultural loop. And so you might think, oh, I don't go to the theatre, so I don't really care. And I don't, I have some sympathy with that view. But if theatre has disappeared overnight, then you would notice the difference in a couple of years for what talent and opportunities and ideas are on your film or on your screen.
James, I know a lot of people will be listening to this podcast and thinking, how can I support the arts? What is it listeners can do?
Well, that's very nice of you to ask, and very nice of you offer help. I mean, I ultimately hope that you won't have to, and that the government will give us a comparatively tiny amount to sustain us. But I guess if you are feeling willing to, once we have a plan for reopening these venues, cinemas, consoles, comedy gigs, music venues, booking a ticket, basically, if you can afford it, will be the most glorious thing that you could do. There's no income from these venues at the moment, not from people turning up on the night to watch the show that night. A lot of income obviously came from advance booking, the people buying tickets to see Hamilton next Christmas meant that they could pay their actors that night. So advance booking would be glorious. So as soon as we have a plan, if you want to come and see a show at any point in the year, that would be really helpful. Thank you.
TV in lockdown has been so important. It has really brought us together with watch-alongs and some incredible TV shows, and it is showing why it's vital to get that industry back on its feet as soon as it's safe to do so. Quiz really did take the nation by storm, which, as we've said, was birthed in theatre.
Yeah, it was. Thank you. That was apart from me moaning about how miserable my lockdown was, that was a really nice few days. It was strange because I was just sat watching it on my own, and you're vaguely aware through social media and other avenues that there is a thing happening. There's a sort of a conversation happening. It just feels very different because you don't. You're just not there. It's not around you. But it was. Yeah, it was really wonderful. We hoped, I guess, there was a conscious effort on behalf of myself and the director, Stephen Frears, to to try and create something that felt a little bit like what it was like to watch television in the time that we were depicting, which was, as you will remember, sort of everyone sitting around watching the same thing at the same time as a family. And we couldn't obviously imagine the horrific circumstances that would lead to that actually being the case. And, you know, locking people up did help to get us those viewing figures and become a bit of a water-cooled thing. But it was lovely. It was lovely to see sort of anecdotally people saying it was the first time in years they got their kids together as a family and they watched the same thing on the same television rather than in different rooms, or that they decided to tune in at 9 o'clock every night to see how the story develops. And yeah, it was really wonderful. It was really wonderful.
Even though it was a really successful play and you look at the incredible cast and Stephen Frears and your own incredible script, were you surprised by the reaction? Because it's officially the most watched drama of the year now.
I was totally surprised. And if I'm honest, during production, I had my main fear was that it was going to be too light, I guess.
Yeah.
That I'd just come off the back of that Brexit film that was very punchy and provocative. And I'd seen the amount of press coverage and commentary that circled that. And I kept thinking, specifically this ITV drama, which I think we all know what the perception is of sometimes, unfairly in my view.
And you made many jokes about that during the show.
And I was very happy to do so. And I was very grateful that ITV let me. I guess they wanted to be in on the joke. That it might feel disposable and that people wouldn't care about this 20-year-old story that had pretty much left the national consciousness. I really loved the comic elements, but I thought, oh God, is it too silly? And I'm so thrilled that the talent that is Stephen Frears and our wonderful cast completely just committed to that tone, because I think it's what people probably needed. And it may have been a bit nostalgic, but actually, and there is a huge danger to nostalgia. But I think because it was nostalgia with a bit of commentary about nostalgia, that maybe it had a value. So yes, I was totally surprised. I was thrilled that people, to reignite people's interest in this bizarre story and have the question going around about this couple's innocence or guilt. Yeah. It was great. It was lovely.
And it's a show that asks so many questions of viewers. It sets up reasonable arguments and premises and then almost discredits them and then discredits that. And of course, the Ingrams case has now gone from being supposedly one of the most open and shut cases we've ever had in this country to being, well, I could probably call 10 different friends and they would all give different answers on whether they were guilty or not. You've obviously spent time with the Ingrams. What are they actually like?
I'm really fond of them. The absolute joy in writing this, as opposed to some of my other shows about politicians or people with power, is that everybody I met across the scale, from the producers of the show to the people they accused of cheating, I really liked. They were they were really lovely. The producers were so passionate about the thing that they made. The Ingrams were so passionate about their innocence, or the crime dealt out to them in all the ways, that the media attention and the mockery and the humiliation was disproportionate and unfair. And I don't disagree with them. The third part of that conspiracy, alleged conspiracy, Tekwin Whittock and his family, this really endearing lecturer from college who had a diagnosed cough.
Yes.
And then was put through this huge trial. But as to what the Ingrams are like, I mean, they're very generous with their time, and their sense of injustice hasn't gone away over 20 years. So they speak very eloquently and passionately about that. They are that wonderful thing as well, which I think the actors really captured. They're sort of examples of great English eccentricity. I mean, he's an army major. Yeah. He acts like one. He acts like how you want an army major to act. And she's this really funny, woman who liked quizzes maybe a bit too much. And then of course you have the thing that was so joyful I found in being able to write was this syndicate of Wiltshire quiz obsessives who basically performed a very English version of Ocean's 11 yes. in trying to hack the world's most popular game show. So to bring those characters like that, to bring those to the screen, and the joy of the fact that you know they exist and they're real is a real privilege.
I mean, often when a drama bills itself as, you know, the untold story, it's a story that most people know. But apart from the coughing, really, I don't think I appreciated any of the nuances of the story.
I think that's right, and that was always my great hope, that people would go, why, you know, you close one eye and read Twitter the moment you announce that you're doing a show about a certain thing, and you prepare yourself for the, Christ, is this what we've come to? I'd rather watch paint dry, et cetera, et cetera. But I always hope that the story was more interesting than people thought. So for example, you know, it's not just these two people, it's not just the major, and in fact, I think most people were probably surprised that he actually wasn't even the main character in episode one. Yeah. It was his brother-in-law and his wife who amazingly got on the show before he did. So I remember actually just thinking back to the night of the first broadcast, that was my one fear, that because of the way I structured it into three episodes, I could find no way at all to get the major into that chair in the first episode. And I was bracing myself for a wave of commentary that was along the lines of, I did smile, and I remember seeing one tweet during the first 10 minutes that basically said, oh, he's not even in the bloody chair yet. And I was like, I knew that he wasn't even getting in the chair till tomorrow night. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to lose the entire audience by the first ad break. But then I forgot the things that I'd written. I forgot that we'd get to meet this glorious syndicate, and then we'd get to meet the family outside the major. I personally think, but I'm a massive dweeb for systems and processes and institutions, but I think the stuff around how they made the show was really interesting, and you know, the fact that the producer had to put his own house on the line and that it wasn't a guaranteed success, and that kind of stuff is hopefully interesting.
I have to say, I thought the third episode in particular was incredible, partly because the recreation of the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire studio was so good. I was trying to work out how the story sustains itself, but then Helen McCrory turns up.
it's a bit of a cheat, isn't it, to drop her in at the third episode. She's so extraordinary, and you know how we one of the source materials for the play and for the TV drama was this book called Bad Show by a journalist, Bob Woffenden, and a chess grandmaster, James Plaskett. And it came out about 5 years ago, and it was the first time that anyone had sort of re-examined this allegedly cut and dry black and white case, and just began bringing all of the defense and all of the many, many contradictions and holes in this theory of their guilt. And I just found that so exciting to delve into, and to be able to store all that stuff up deliberately in your arsenal and wait to the third episode to then begin unleashing point after point.
Yeah.
All of the disparities that you deliberately try to lead the audience into believing in the first two episodes and then pulling the rug under in the third. It was really fun.
I mean, Helen McCrory, she could bend the will of the gods. I've never been so excited by a court scene.
Thank you. I mean, we did get a lot of very fair criticism from actual lawyers about the very theatrical nature of our courts and, you know, barristers pacing around and that kind of thing. But I mean, I think to our credit, we in the ways that you sort of said about the ITV references, we sort of tried to make it quite knowingly artificial and a court drama about a courtroom drama where we could take some of those liberties. It's she was a wise man. What's strange actually about Ted, the difference between producing television and watching television is often the disparity about how much screen time an actor gets and how much time they're actually on set.
Yeah.
So Helen McCrory never left the screen really in episode three, so for a third of the television drama. But she probably only came on set for 2 days and just did all of that stuff in a couple of takes. And you just go, thanks, that's great, we've got it, you can go home. And she was such a pro.
I mean, those court scenes reminded me a little bit of Line of Duty and its interrogation scene, that gladiatorial nature, the way the game flips on its head in a moment. I mean, that must have been a joy to write those scenes.
Yeah, I started to think about it as, you know, the classic Aaron Sorkin film, A Few Good Men,
yeah.
Where Jack Nicholson cousin walks in and says, "You can't handle the truth." You know, you're building to that moment, except you're doing it with where the piece of evidence that gets dropped at the end is the fact that the lecturer actually had a cough. You know, it's not Hollywood stuff, but it's we wanted to create those moments of real drama. And I suppose structurally, I lined up all of the evidence for their defence as I saw it. And I thought the most compelling argument, the one to keep to the very end, is a moment where, if you remember the drama, where Helen McCrory is sort of wrapping up her questioning of the television producer. And she lands the point at the very end, which is basically, how do you explain the questions he got right,
yeah,
where there was no coughing at all? And the defence was that, he didn't need any coughs on those answers because he knew those answers. And the very obvious point to come back to on that is, well, how did this guy know that he knew those answers? And yeah, so he didn't need to cough. They'd never met. They didn't know one another. How would he know? Oh, I don't need to cough now because this person I've never met already knows the answer to this question. It's, you go, oh yeah, that's really weird. So you try, exactly as you put, you try and find the drama by building the most convincing points in this kind of escalating sense of bit of development.
And after the show aired, there was a lot of calls for ITV to air the original episode after Quiz had aired. Do you think they ever will, or is Quiz the closest we'll ever come to seeing that in full?
Well, it just exists. It's on YouTube, and anyone can watch it. But of course, as we reminded people in the television drama, there is no unedited version of it, and the version of that, of the major's performance that you'll see on YouTube, has those coughs, but those coughs are amplified.
Yeah.
And the prosecution made a not unreasonable case for why they had to do that. They wanted to replicate what it's like to listen to something in a way, and therefore they had tried to replicate what the major was hearing. But yes, you watch that and you go, oh my God, it's so obvious. And that's problematic because it's not obvious.
And finally, James, what else have you been watching during lockdown?
Well, you know, my own stuff on a loop again and again. No, I'm kidding. I have been, like everybody else probably, I absolutely adored Normal People, and I adored actually how it was structured, the rhythm of that, the bite-sized nature of those half-an-hour episodes were just deliciously wonderful, and I tried to spread them out as much as possible.
I did the same, actually. I spread them out as well, and I have to say, half an hour is a really, really good format at the moment.
Yeah, I agree. It's it just meant every episode had its own unique identity. Every episode was about a thing, a character's particular dilemma or something that a character found uniquely difficult. It was great. And again, that is by a playwright, Alice Birch. She adapted the majority of that series. I returned to The Ozarks on Netflix. I left it a bit in the second series. I thought the second series trod a bit of water. But I thought the third series was bleakly wonderful, and an amazing performance by Janet McTeer, one of our great British actresses.
I have to say, that's not one I've watched at all. I've always missed Ozark. Why should we watch it?
I'm wary of leading you towards it because it's incredibly violent and incredibly bleak. It does not make you feel good about the world or about people, but it's just so well produced and it's so shocking. You just don't know from in a Game of Thrones way, you don't know from scene to scene which characters you're going to lose.
Yeah.
And it's very compelling.
Are you getting stuck into box sets, or are you just trying to do smaller series?
Yeah, not really. I'm happy to, for the gods of linear television or the algorithm to deliver things to me, and I will consume it. I'm not actively seeking things out. I've been returning to episodes of The West Wing a bit, but again, only as and when I think Sky Atlantic deems it possible for me to do so. I'm not putting on a DVD, but they've been going through it episode by episode again, and we just got to the end of the series, I think this week. That's been glorious. That's been great.
Have you listened to the West Wing podcast?
No, I haven't actually. People talk about that. From the guy who destroyed the West Wing, as he claims, what's the actual thought? But yes. No, I should do that.
It's really good. I sort of want to start watching The West Wing all over again just to listen to that as almost some kind of post-show book club.
Yeah, it's It's not perfect. It has that slight American sentimentality towards their own glorious democracy, with all of its many flaws. But I think there's one. This is the stuff I sort of love to write and try to replicate in our own British equivalent. It's all the strange anachronisms and bizarre elements to our unwritten constitution that I sometimes think are really, really exciting. And there's an amazing episode of The West Wing. I think it's the end of series four, where they obviously, clearly what the writing team did was they looked at all the vulnerabilities of this system and said, how can we send an Exocet missile into it? So they created a situation where the vice president had resigned, and then the president, Jed Bartlett, had to relinquish control because his daughter had been kidnapped. And then so you go down the hierarchy of American power, you go, well, who's next? And it's the Speaker of the House. And of course, what the American system allows for is the Speaker of the House can be from the different party. So you have this character, John Goodman, who's a Republican, coming into the White House to become the temporary president in a Democratic party. And it's absolutely glorious, absolutely brilliant to construct that to look what is absurd about our system and let's run with it. But of course, then it was the end of that story was very moving in the way that it demonstrated once the president could return that speaker relinquished that power very amiably and handed it over and went back to his job. And I just love that stuff. I love it.
I think John Goodman almost immediately tries to declare war, I think.
Yeah, there's a bit where he doesn't behave brilliantly. And he brings his own advisors in, and obviously they enact different ideological policy. But then as soon as the president comes back, he signs a paper and says good luck and returns to his job.
Oh, I'm definitely going to restart The West Wing again. James, thank you so much. That was brilliant.
You're so welcome. Thanks. Good to talk.
Do you know what? If James had mentioned The West Wing at the start, that's all we would have talked about. And I can't believe it has taken 7 episodes to talk about CITV game show Finders Keepers. Seriously, if you were ever wronged on that show, please, please get in touch, because I really want Michael Sheen to play Neil Buchanan in that. Oh, could you imagine it? Thank you so much to James for doing that. He was incredibly busy last week and he managed to find some time to fit that in. I will add some links in the bio on ways you can help support theatre and the arts, which, as James says, were the first to close and will be the last to reopen. I should also point out that this was recorded just a few hours before the Dominic Cummings road trip was announced. So our little laugh about him was just because, well, that was episode 7 of the Quarantine Break podcast. Please continue to subscribe for new episodes first, and please tell your friends. I'll be back very, very soon, but in the meantime, please stay indoors.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.